Welcome to a special extended edition of the Reloop Brief ahead of INC 5.2. We'll be focusing on what a primary plastic polymer fee could mean, but first we'll find out a bit more about where we currently are with the Global Plastic Treaty negotiations. First, some introductions. I'm Barry, the Director of Communications at Reloop, and on the podcast we'll hear from Hugo Schally in Brussels, a retired official of the European Commission with a background in plastic policy and a former global negotiator relating to plastics.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here and to talk about this exciting subject.
Oliver Boachie is in Ghana and is currently the Managing Consultant for the Centre of Environment and Circular Affairs in Accra.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here with you on this podcast.
And throughout the podcast, we'll hear from Clarissa Morosky, Reloop CEO and co-founder.
Delighted to be here. Thank you, Barry.
Now, before we get into the current situation and the primary plastic polymer fee, we'll hear from each of our guests on their involvement with the Global Plastic Treaty so far.
Barry, for the last 10 years, I would say, I've been very closely involved with issues related to sustainability, plastics, plastics production, plastic waste, as an official of the European Commission. And as the time went on, I was the EU's lead negotiator for the first rounds of the INC negotiations. I've retired at the end of last year, and now I'm advising the Shape Foundation as one of the actors in advancing some of the more interesting subjects on certain aspects of the negotiations.
And Oliver, yourself?
Yes, until January of this year, I was serving as the special advisor to the Minister of Environment, Science, Technology and Innovation in Ghana. And in that role, I represented Ghana first as the focal point for the INC for ending plastic pollution, and later also served as the chair of the African Group of Negotiators and co-chair for the negotiations that have taken place since 2022.
Clarissa, can you talk us through Reloop's involvement so far?
Yeah, so starting with the fact that Reloop is an accredited United Nations NGO, so we are invited to submit our opinions on different things. So from the beginning, we've been going to the INC meetings and we've submitted a significant number of documents advising the United Nations on how to treat different topics within the treaty. We've been reaching out to some of our global experts that have been working with us, and we are hoping that certainly with this issue that we're focusing on, the polymer premium issue, we can gain a little leverage and get some text into the treaty so that we can start to initiate this particular initiative.
We're going to talk about the primary plastic polymer fee in a few moments' time. Hugo, maybe you could give us a little bit background of what the INC negotiations are about and how we got to where we are just now.
The issue of plastic pollution has been on the minds of the international community for a long time, and it first emerged on the political scene at UNEA 3 in 2017, at which point there was a declaration that basically said business as usual with regard to plastic is not an option and something must be done about it. Having said that, it lasted another 5 years until UNEA 5 in 2022, until the global community could agree on a mandate to start the negotiations for an agreement on plastic pollution. Now, the difference of opinion from the very starting point was always the scope of that agreement, which means should we tackle mainly the source of the pollution, which is production and use, or should the focus be on the end of pipe problems, which is waste collection and waste management. And that sort of goes through the whole negotiations where different group of countries have different focal areas of concern. In that context, of course, the question was always also that there were many countries that were dependent on new and additional financing for implementing possible obligations under the agreement. And that in view of the breadth and the challenges and the investment volume necessary, there was also an idea that we would need to tap new sources. And in that context, the ideas about how to fully operationalize the polluter pays concept in the context of a future agreement came about. And that is, as we will in a little while come back, the idea of a fee on primary polymer production came into being and is part of the overall discussions. Currently, I would say that we are in a very critical situation ahead of the second session of the fifth meeting of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee, as positions have crystallized and you can put essentially three groups of countries in these negotiations that have different positions on various issues. We can talk about that in more detail if necessary, but it is sort of at the critical juncture and it is very uncertain to what extent it will be possible to come to an agreement in the negotiations that will take place in Geneva in August.
And you've hit the nail on the head there, saying if we get to an agreement, what would you say is stopping us getting there then? Is there anything specifically you can pinpoint to us today?
I think that one critical issue is the issue of whether the agreement should regulate in whatever way, shape or form the production of primary plastic polymers, which is a major political issue in the discussions. The second is whether the agreement should regulate in any way the production and use of chemicals that are contained within plastics. And the third, of course, is of a slightly different nature. How are we going to raise the necessary financial resources that will be necessary to support especially developing countries in implementing potential future obligations under that agreement? I would say those are the three critical things. And again, as I think we will be able to discuss, the concept of the plastic fee will play quite a crucial role in that regard.
And what about the sort of the blocks that are going on? Obviously, we've heard quite a lot about, we're at 5.2 already. We didn't necessarily expect that. Can you speak to that at all?
There are, as I said, in my mind, essentially three groups of countries that participate in the negotiation. And it's not super defined. Sometimes the lines are a little bit blurred. I would say there is a group of countries, mainly those who are very much dependent on either primary polymer production because of the products they place on the market or on primary polymer production because of the natural resources that they have. I'm talking about essentially the Gulf countries, Iran, the Russian Federation, to a degree Indonesia and others, that really want to limit any agreement to the waste management and collection stage and want to leave production untouched. There is another large group of countries, most of which are organized in the High Ambition Coalition, that spans the different regional and geographic groups because it has countries from Europe, North America, Asia, Latin America, Africa, and Oceania. And those would be the ones who are pushing for an ambitious agreement that includes obligations on production, obligations on the use of certain chemicals, obligations on the use of certain instruments such as extended producer responsibility schemes, and so on. Many of them are also quite open to discussing the role of a plastic polymer production fee in the context of the establishment of the agreement. And then there are countries in the middle that, while being sympathetic to the idea of an ambitious agreement, do not subscribe fully to the most ambitious approach in that regard. And I would, for instance, categorize Brazil as a typical case in that one. That is a discussion that transcends the normal North-South systematic of negotiations. But then when you get into the discussion of financial mechanism and how to support implementation, there is a more clear-cut North-South division where the Global South is quite united in demanding a specific financial mechanism for this instrument, whereas the countries of the North are more skeptical about the added value of having yet another additional financial mechanism, rather being interested in discussing where would the money to feed any such mechanism come from. Again, an issue where the discussion of the plastic fee can be of interest, and that has blocked progress to a large extent.
Just a quick question about the three groups of countries. Where does the United States fall now that there is a new president there?
That's a very interesting question. The US has, until the end of last year, been a fairly constructive player while maintaining quite some distance to the more ambitious parts of the future agreement, certainly not very open to production caps, not fully convinced about the version of chemicals control that many ambitious countries had, and obviously playing its own narrative on the issue of financial mechanisms. Now, in the wake of the coming into office of the new administration, of course, some of that skeptical elements will become stronger. And I think that we would have to expect probably that the US will be less constructive on certain elements than it has been so far.
What I can add to that is that I think things have been slow up to IEC 5. This started sometime in Paris. I think that was the second INC. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to really address the issues and getting the various parties to want to reach some consensus. And that is what has led us to INC 5.2. And I'm hoping that member states will see the need for us to be constructive and to get a treaty that is ambitious enough to enable us to achieve most of our petitions.
Just to go back, Hugo, I think just for a second. So what's the next stage? What are we looking out for at INC 5.2? What's the most likely scenario coming out of this then?
I think that what will happen is everybody's guess. There are, in my mind, a couple of scenarios, and I'm sure that Oliver will be glad to comment on that as well. There is, unfortunately, a very negative scenario, which would mean that for some reason the talks actually collapse and they reach a point where the continuing will become very difficult. There is a second scenario that sees limited progress but will not allow conclusion, and that could mean that the negotiations could be continued, which then could lead into a very lengthy additional negotiations. Let us remember that a recently concluded important agreement for marine protected areas took 10 years to negotiate. So I don't think we want to go there. And there is a third scenario that in the hope and aspiration to conclude negotiations, there would be only a very generic and general framework agreement agreed, and based on that, further development would take place. I do not want to pronounce myself on the likelihood of any of the options. I would say that the doomsday option is the least likely in my mind. So the two others are, I think, quite possible, depending on the rate of progress in that regard.
I just have a quick follow-up, Hugo. On the third option, which you call the generic framework, which would require further development, does this effectively mean that there would be an annual conference of the parties to further develop the generic framework like there is with the Paris Agreement?
That would happen in any case, whatever form of agreement we would reach. When I'm saying a generic agreement, what many in the negotiations have referred to would be an agreement that would be as generic as Vienna Convention on the Ozone Layer, which actually was the basis for developing the Montreal Protocol with very specific obligations. So it would basically be a framework convention or a framework agreement that would be complemented, for instance, by amendments or by protocols in that regard. Again, the result is pretty much the same as with the second option. It means a continuation of negotiations in another form, but the advantage of it being that we would actually have an agreement in place on which we could build. It always depends on what's in that agreement, obviously.
I'd like to move to the primary plastic polymer fee and start with the basics. Hugo, I think we'll start with yourself. Can you explain to me what it is in simple terms and how it works?
The concept that has been put forward is that we would look at those companies that are the main producers and suppliers of primary plastic polymer, because they are not directly contributing in any way, shape or form to solutions for plastic waste and plastic pollution. When you look at the mid value chain approaches and end value chain approaches, such as the extended producer responsibility schemes, they're basically confined to the countries where the economic activity that involves placing on the market of plastic products is involved. Whereas the primary plastic polymers come from a limited number of companies in a limited number of countries and contribute very much to the supply of plastic polymers that are at the source of the pollution worldwide. The simple idea is that all those who are directly or indirectly responsible for plastic pollution should also contribute to the solutions to it, which means also contribute financially to implementing solutions in countries that may not have the capacity otherwise to do that.
Thank you. And Oliver, I'm going to bring you back in. I know we got a good explanation of what this fee is, but is there anything you would like to add to that and how it came about?
Yes. The recognition is that there is a huge gap that exists between what traditional funding from developed countries will be able to provide and what is actually needed for us to be able to implement this treaty effectively. And the gap has been estimated to be anywhere around $30 to $35 billion a year, mostly for developing countries. And to fill this gap, we've found the need, as Hugo said, to extend the polluter pays principle to cover the primary polymer producers who until now have not been held to account in their role in the production and use and then the disposal of plastics. And that is why the fee has been proposed to cover just a few of the large producers who we all know are the ones who produce the most globally and whose products end up in the production of all the different kinds of plastics that are found on all markets. And yes, the idea is now to hold the primary polymer producers also to account and not just leave the obligation to those who are using plastic to package their products, such as the Coca-Cola's, the Nestle's, and others who use plastic just for packaging, but to extend the responsibility to those who are producing the basic elements that eventually turn into all the different kinds of plastics.
Oliver, I wonder if I could ask you, just so we understand what financial implication we're talking about, how much is this, say, per ton produced? How much money are we talking about? And then what does that translate into per bottle, let's say, per water bottle put on the market, so we understand the price that this is going to cost these producers?
First of all, putting a levy on the production of polymers could be so large that it would serve as a control measure for producers to even see the need to lower the level of production. But we realize that if that was done, we'll have to set the fee at a very, very high level, which could backfire and actually demotivate our member states from even considering the idea of a levy. And based on modeling that was done by various institutions, it was determined that if the levy was set at a level that is lower than maybe even $90 per ton, it will really raise the amount of money that you need to help the developing countries. And it will have very minimal effect on prices that exist on the market for the various products. In fact, the study that have been done by Mindero, OECD, and other institutions have all come to the conclusion that if you just want to raise money to help developing countries, we can set the fee anywhere from $60 to $90 per ton. It will have very little effect on the cost of production. And because the developing countries and others need these funds so much, we have also considered the effect that it will have on the price, the consumer level. And also at that point, you see that is very, very minimal, less than 1% of the cost increase that is likely to come out of this.
Yeah, I'm just actually running the math at my end as well. At $90 a ton would be about 0.2 of a penny for an average plastic bottle, which is, of course, hardly anything when you think about what that money can be used for. Thanks, Oliver.
Exactly.
So we've actually got on our website, we talk about the fee, we say small fee, big impact. Oliver, can you explain maybe just a little bit what that money would do and how it would be used and why we're talking about this in the first place?
Yes, the resolution that established the basis for these negotiations actually called for some three or four key things. First, we want to be able to provide the necessary infrastructure, especially for developing countries, to be able to collect, process, and transport, sort, and recycle plastics. So the first area of application of the fee will be on the provisioning of infrastructure for waste management, especially for developing countries. The other thing that the evolution calls for is to create a circular economy within the plastics industry. The third thing is to address existing plastic pollution, what we call legacy plastic pollution. Many countries, especially in the developing world, has huge problems of plastic on the land and in the marine environment. And these are the fees that we want to collect are supposed to help countries address these challenges. We believe that not too many developed countries will be willing to provide funding to address legacy plastic. And the last thing that we have also found the need to raise additional funding is on what we call the just transition, to make sure that those heavily involved in waste management, especially women and other vulnerable segments of society, if we are going to be able to address this plastic pollution, we need to support them adequately for them to continue to support the management of plastic waste in the developing countries and in the island states as well.
It sounds to me, in really simple terms, a bit of a no-brainer. Would you agree with that, Hugo?
I do agree with that, and Oliver has described the needs very well. I think it obviously depends also on the level of commitment that will be expressed through the final agreement, because that sort of will generate the need for action at that one. The second, and I think I want to add that to what Oliver has so aptly explained, is that we are in a situation globally where the traditional ways of financing the implementation of actions under agreements is no longer workable because the funding basis is shrinking. And we also need to go in a direction where all those who contribute to the issue and the problem should bear their fair share in solving the issue. And I think that's why the plastic fee is such a crucial component in bringing in all the actors and making sure that there is a contribution to solving and addressing the problems in all together. And I think that's quite an important element.
I guess what I don't fully understand, and it's not for me to work out, so I'm glad I don't have to do the sums, how does the money travel? How does it get to where it needs to be? How do we make sure that happens?
If I may start off and Oliver may come in, I think that we need to envisage that in stages. First, we need to have a clear recognition in the treaty that such an economic instrument, such as the plastic production fee, can be used to generate and mobilize funding. The second is that it needs also to be recognized that some of that funding could go to finance the implementation of the agreement in countries that do not have the financial and in governance capacity at present to do so. That would mean that we would have a system that would ensure that money would go to a financial mechanism to be defined under the agreement. And from there, it would be distributed to countries that actually implement actions in support of the implementation of the obligations under this agreement. So I think that is a schematic way of seeing it. It's clear that will require, even if we come to an agreement in August, that will require some follow-up work in the international area to clearly establish the link between the raising of the financial resources and their distribution by a system to be governed by the agreement.
Yes. The fees that are collected can be earmarked for specific activities such as addressing existing plastic pollution. And that is where the idea of a remediation fund comes in. So that would be a new fund that will be created, targeted specifically for issues associated with the same plastic pollution and perhaps the just transition. And I was going to add is whether or not we should establish a new dedicated multilateral environment fund for this INC, or to use existing instruments such as the Global Environment Facility, DEF, or other existing instruments. And more or less, I think at INC 5.1, there was this feeling of an agreement or consensus coming together to do a hybrid so that we can use existing facilities in some cases, such as the establishment of the remediation fund, while we are establishing a new dedicated fund specifically for these instruments. And we believe that with these new initiatives, making it voluntary and also having a hybrid form that includes existing funds and the new dedicated fund, we'll be able to reach some consensus telling going to INC 5.2.
I hope you're right.
I hope so too.
I have a question, Hugo, maybe you could answer this. We've talked a lot about the how the money could be used. And I want to understand, there's also been a lot of focus on extended producer responsibility in terms of private investment. How does this work alongside EPR, extended producer responsibility, if that too is a success and there's money flowing in from that?
It would be a complement to the existing or to be established EPR schemes in countries around the world. But as I said in the very beginning, the EPR schemes that exist right now are mid-value chain or end-of-value chain systems that focus very much on the finished products and on the waste stage. And obviously, they bring in a limited amount of money that is linked directly to waste collection and waste management. So as also be said by Oliver, the plastic polymer production fee would actually bring in additional money that could be used towards other needs that are mostly not covered by EPR schemes. There's an additional element there. I think what is also important to bear in mind that there is, I think, a growing general awareness that traditional ways of structuring funding for the implementation of multilateral environmental agreements that was very strongly dependent on public money is not going to be able to cover the needs that exist, and therefore the need to have tools like the plastic production fee that would bring in money from the primary producers and therefore generate additional resources and additional income. And I think that based on experiences with other discussions, there is more readiness to look at the establishment of new financial mechanisms or operating entities for financial mechanisms if it is not trying to access the same pots of public money that are already in the other funds. And I think that what makes the plastic production fee such an interesting approach in the context of the negotiation of the treaty.
And just finally then, Hugo, what if some countries were to implement this and others weren't? Now, we put out some stuff on this saying that it would still have a big impact. Is that possible? Is that workable? And would that be a benefit?
I think the idea, of course, would be to bring the major producers in. So I think we're talking about something like 100 companies in 30-something countries. Now, the question is, to what extent would the parties to the agreement then incentivize the companies within their jurisdiction to participate? And I think that would also be quite important to structure in a way that it becomes an incentive so that companies and countries that are suppliers are actually building a positive image for themselves or a negative image of themselves. Let's not forget the primary plastic production is a highly competitive business. And in the highly competitive business, there is on the one hand the issue of price and on the other hand the issue of reputation and reliability. So if we can actually play the two of them together, there might be quite a compelling case for companies to participate in the scheme, especially since the actual economic impact, we've discussed that, is so low, so that it is a very small investment for them with a rather huge output that can be used. Also in the view of continued use of plastic in many applications, because let's not forget, plastic has been given a bad name because of its environmental impact. If throughout a negotiation and agreement of such a treaty, we could remediate some of that, it will actually also be a good business case for plastic producers to be part of that.
It's almost like a license to operate, one could say.
It is something that comes close to that, yes.
Before we wrap things up, I want to extend my thank you to everybody on this line. Clarissa, I don't know if you want to ask any final questions while we're all here.
No, I just wanted to say thank you very much to both of you. And I wish you, Oliver, I know you're going to be at INC 5.2. I wish you luck in getting some powerful text on the polymer premium there. And I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Clarissa is still with us on the podcast, but to wrap things up on this episode, I wanted to get your thoughts on the tensions that we heard about there.
There's a block content to talk about waste management or end of pipe versus a coalition pressing to regulate above pipe or upstream on chemicals, production caps, design, producer accountability, etc. So I think where the United States ultimately lands could decide whether we get a minimally incremental waste deal or some sort of real scaffolding for real upstream change. In terms of controls on virgin polymer production, this is a very big ship, and I'm not convinced the UN is the helm that will turn it. But even for end of pipe, there is a very real need for financing and support to build knowledge and infrastructure beyond status quo to properly manage the waste that nations are unable to deal with now. Now, this is urgent. So this polymer premium idea, which we've heard about from Hugo and Oliver, which is really very, very small amount of money, can have a huge impact to combat plastic pollution in the short and long term.
What about your predictions for INC 5.2?
Let me put on my optimistic hat. Even if the treaty underdelivers, countries can carry new knowledge home. They can move nationally, sometimes faster and farther outside of the UN process. And ReLoop remains engaged for exactly that reason, to help governments translate lessons into policy, whether it's EPR, deposit return, reuse, recycled content, chemical disclosures, transparency measures, etc. The progress is still within reach. Should we be disappointed with the Geneva outputs, the reaction actually could catalyze a new wave of national ambition. Let's be ready to convert any global frustration into country-level deeds. So I wish the team that is going to be attending INC 5.2 all of the best, especially our colleagues who will be on the ground, for a very good outcome. But I think we need to prepare ourselves for an outcome that is less than ambitious.
Of course, if you want to read more on the plastic polymer fee and the work that ReLoop has done on the Global Plastic Treaty so far, visit the website. It's reloopplatform.org. We'll also be producing a podcast to look at the situation following INC 5.2 as well. Thanks for listening, and remember you can subscribe or follow to get details of the next podcast directly.